Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. This week, we'll catch up on some great stories we've missed on the program over the last several weeks. A living, breathing thing as Lake Powell drops, Glen Canyon's once lush ecosystem returns. He's not a scientist, but he's on a mission to save the Great Salt Lake, one piece of clothing at a time. Here's why Utah has become one of America's surprising plastic surgery hotspots. And after only 2 years, a new language class has hundreds of students connecting to their culture. Those are some of the stories we'll be talking about in the program. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. Right now, we bring in reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to catch up with you on this story. By the way, beautiful photographs in here and a trip you took in Glen Canyon. Here's the headline, a living, breathing thing as Lake Powell drops, Glen Canyon's once lush ecosystem returns. Of course, when the dam was put in and the lake started to fill, Glen Canyon, this mythical canyon, was flooded. But in recent years, the level of Lake Powell has been dropping.
Yeah, so as it's been dropping, once flooded canyons are returning. And, you know, in the first few years of that return, it looks like, you know, thistle and tumbleweed and invasive species, but pretty soon some native plants come back, and along with, you know, animals and insects that come with that. So yeah, it's an interesting time down there for sure.
You write in the story, it took nearly 20 years for the Lake Powell to fill up to 3,700 feet in elevation, stayed at that level for about 20 years, and now, I guess what, 20 years-ish of shrinking?
Yeah, so it's interesting that it only stayed, you know, kind of around that level. Obviously, there are ups and downs for a couple decades, and then in the past 2 decades, we've been in this really intense drought, and the reservoir has been dropping, so changing times. And obviously we had very little snowpack, warm winter this year too. So the lake is potentially going to drop to the lowest level we've seen since that filling began.
So tell me about this trip. Who organized it, and who'd you go with?
Yeah, so we were invited to write about this trip as reporters that the Glen Canyon Institute and Returning Rapids Project organized. So those are two organizations that have been documenting what is returning as the reservoir drops. And they also invited along, you know, several environmental nonprofit leaders from, you know, folks that work at Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance to, you know, Western Resource Advocates, all the main environmental groups that work on Colorado River issues to see what's happening here and have conversations about the future of this place.
So as I understand, you start on one side of Lake Powell, put it boats several hours across the reservoir, which is still pretty big. And and then tell me about you're entering now into places that used to be completely flooded.
Yeah. So, you know, what we really focus on in this story that went up a few weeks ago is a hike we took up Davis Gulch, which is one of the 127 side canyons that have reemerged, and that's specifically in like the Escalante arm. So, you know, where the Escalante River would have been running as a river before. And, you know, you start entering that and it's really kind of waterlogged, wobbly soils, you know, your feet are sinking in. The plants are maybe just at kind of like your ankle or shin height. And then as you keep going further, you start to stumble upon like beaver dams and the water pools, and the plants start to get taller and taller. We saw toads and frogs, you know, the insects and birds start popping up too. And Eventually those willows that started just like ankle or shin height at the bottom are, towering above your head as you get deeper up into this canyon. So it was a pretty interesting experience just seeing the ecological recovery. And, the deeper you get into the canyon, those areas have been out of the water longer. So that's just why you see more of this plant and animal life the further up you go.
I'm trying to find this quote, Eric Balkin from was it Glen Canyon Institutes. He essentially said it, doesn't need human intervention. Once the water recedes, nature comes back.
Yeah, I think that was an interest really interesting thing to see here. I mean, something that was discussed on that trip is just environmental groups, conservation groups, government agencies are spending millions of dollars on ecosystem recovery, across Utah, across the West. And one of the big things people groups have been doing has been like reintroducing beavers or like what's called beaver dam analogs, because that is so beneficial, especially to like waterways, stream ecosystems. And so I think, what Eric Balkin was getting at is like, in so many places, humans are doing so much to bring beavers back, or at least, manage the ecosystem in a way like a beaver would have. And here the beavers have come back on their own. They are doing the work in this ecosystem on their own. And I think that was really interesting for, some of these nonprofit leaders to see who are maybe doing this ecosystem recovery in other places where it is taking a lot of money and a lot of resources.
It's interesting how this happens, this process. There's a photo in here of a tumbleweed, which is, I guess, officially I should be calling it Russian thistle. That's what you have in your story. Not non-native plant, but apparently, once the Lake Powell recedes, then the kind of the natural cycle of, flash flooding, et cetera, washes some of that out, and native plants thrive. Is that what happens?
Yeah, so in the first, year or two, this is what scientists have at least documented that have been going into these canyons. I specifically talked with Seth Ahrens, who's been doing plant surveys of, about 20 side canyons that have surfaced. And so what he's found is in the first year or two, it's a lot of invasive non-native plants like Russian thistle or tumbleweed. But eventually, the canyons kind of start to return to sort of the hydrology that they may have had before, or at least something more similar. I mean, it's still, a different environment for sure. There's a ton of sediment in there that wasn't before, but eventually rains come, they dump into these canyons, they form these flash floods, and that rushing water can kind of carve a new stream channel. And then plant life can return, like native plant life, grasses and shrubs that, really thrive in that kind of stream creek environment. And then that slowly starts to change the soil and, the earth around that. And eventually it's just kind of this cascading cycle that other plant and animal life can return as well.
So it's been many years underwater now, emerging. So I imagine a lot of sediment. Does that get washed away? And human trash. You get, beer cans and such in some places.
So that's a big issue with Lake Powell dropping, as the Colorado River system carries a ton of sediment. We have these sandstone rock features, and the river carries that, is eroding these rocks constantly, and all the sand and clay has been settling in Lake Powell. And as the reservoir drops, anywhere from 10 to 70-ish feet of sand, clay, and shale has been left in the reservoir's tracks in these side canyons. And the large canyons, like in Cataract Canyon, where the main stem of the Colorado River flows, there's been about 200 feet of sediment, and that's constantly eroding as the river changes, but there's a lot of sand and clay. These side canyons, they're recovering ecosystem-wise, and as these streams and creeks come back, that's also, washing away some of that sediment. But especially at first, it's not like, I don't know, but for people who have hiked in, kind of washes or side canyons throughout southern Utah, there's a lot of like actual rock in the bottom of these canyons, and that's how some of these areas were historically. But you're not going to see that as much here just because there is that sediment layer that's been piled up in these canyons.
Tell me a bit more about the wildlife. You mentioned frogs, beavers. There's a photo here of a great blue heron. What kinds of wildlife is there?
Yeah, there's a great photo of great blue heron. Francisco, trip photographer, got just some amazing photos. That's one of my favorites. The beavers that I mentioned, they, are playing a massive role in facilitating all this other life coming back. Beavers are known as nature's engineers, so they build their dams that creates these pools of water where, frogs and fish and all these other, amphibians and other life can live. And the plant life, there's willows. We have some cottonwoods coming back, which, is larger tree species, cattails, grasses, reeds, some wildflowers. So a pretty big diversity of plant life. People pointed out other things to me, and these are primarily environmental nonprofit staff that were on this trip, and some of them have science background, but they weren't, scientists to tell me for sure, but people speculated when we saw, something that looked like otter scat or maybe coyote or maybe even mountain lion, like just things like that that people were pointing out. So yeah, lots of signs of animals and, abundant plant life too.
I was interested to learn here. Glen Canyon Institute has set up a Glen Canyon Restoring Ecosystems project on iNaturalist. So I guess they're seeking help from citizen scientists.
So they have started this, what they're calling a community science program or, citizen science program. And it's basically if you go onto and we link to it in the story to their page on iNaturalist, you can upload your observations if you go down there. These side canyons, people who go on trips in Powell will take their boat up to them and go on these hikes that we were on. It's not wasn't like we ran into a ton of people, but we ran into a few groups. So that's an opportunity for those folks. And I believe Glen Canyon Institute is also trying to organize some official trips in the future too that people may be able to go on. But for now, there's this iNaturalist page where you can contribute your findings. And part of why they're doing this is just the National Park Service doesn't necessarily have the resources to be doing extensive research of everything that's returning at the scale that at least Glen Canyon Institute would like to see. And so, scientists and just community scientists, regular people going in and entering these things in iNaturalist is helping to identify some of what the change is happening.
One of the people that went on you on this trip to Glen Canyon, his name is Zana Stutz, and here's quoting from your story. Zana Stutz says, "One of the worst things that could happen to Glen Canyon already happened." And then you note the generation of Katie Lee, the famous singer, avid defender of Glen Canyon until her passing, were moved by what they lost. And Stutz says, but now her generation of 20-somethings is motivated by what's returning. And she says, "We're rewriting the narrative."
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting and kind of a powerful shift. There was and still is this whole generation that has advocated for Glen Canyon, mourned its flooding. You mentioned, and Zana mentioned Katie Lee. Zana also works for Glen Canyon Institute, and I think she sees, as you just mentioned, this generational shift where Zana and other 20-somethings never got to see Glen Canyon before Lake Powell was a thing. They've heard these stories, and for I think, generations even kind of in between the 20-somethings and, people in their 70s or older that maybe saw it before. I think for a long time, people thought they would never see any parts of Glen Canyon in their life, and now they are, and so I think what people are motivated by isn't necessarily the loss, maybe. Maybe for some people that's still there, but at least for younger generations, there's this kind of hopeful story of how ecosystems can recover, and that, this isn't just a loss. It's a constantly changing place, So I think that was interesting, just that shift in narrative.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson, telling us about her trip to Glen Canyon. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And coming up following a break, we'll be bringing in Salt Lake Tribune culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. Among the stories we'll be talking about are these. He's not a scientist, but he's on a mission to save the Great Salt Lake, one piece of clothing at a time. And here's why Utah has become one of America's surprising plastic surgery hotspots. We'll have more with Behind the Headlines following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. This week, we're catching up on some great stories we've missed on the program over the last several weeks. And we turn in this segment to culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. Palak, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here's some of the headlines. We want to get to as many of these as we can. A lot of interesting stories. He's not a scientist, but he's on a mission to save the Great Salt Lake, one piece of clothing at a time. Here's why Utah has become one of America's surprising plastic surgery hotspots. And after only 2 years, a new language class has hundreds of students connecting to their culture. Some of the stories we'll talk about. Let's talk about the story which just published today. We're recording on Monday. This is a story about the Great Salt Lake and a clothing line. Tell me about this.
I think to tell the story of this clothing line, GSL Luxury, I have to start by telling the story of the creative director, Chris Carlson. So Chris Carlson, the lead of my story is Chris Carlson is neither scientist nor scholar, but there may be few who understand the Great Salt Lake the way he does. And we kind of set up Chris's backstory here. He has this almost spiritual connection to this body of water in Utah that, has been at the forefront of Utah news for years and years, and especially lately. And so when I interviewed Chris, he immediately led with that. He was like, "I am just so fascinated with this lake." And Chris is a photographer. So what we did was we started talking through some of the photographs that he's taken. He knows every inch of this lake in the surrounding area. He's photographed, the north arm of the lake, the south arm of the lake. He's photographed the wildlife that, it sustains itself from this lake. And that was really what inspired me to tell Chris's story. And because he is so fascinated with this, he was dreaming about the Great Salt Lake, which I think is such an interesting thing. And one of the dreams he had was about a photograph he took of these evaporation ponds at the Great Salt Lake. The pictures are in the story. So if people want to see what it looks like, they can read it. But there's a very specific picture Chris has taken where you can see different colors, almost like a grid, of these evaporation ponds. And there's a green, there's a pink. And so he kind of went to bed and he dreamed of this picture as a dress, and particularly this dress from 1965 from the, I'm going to butcher this name, but the Yves Saint Laurent line. It's the 1965 Mondrian dress, which is really this geometric, blocky dress that was really popular at the time. And so Chris woke up. He had a sketchbook next to his bed and he drew out that dress. And that was one of 20 designs he ended up drawing, inspired by his photography. So that's kind of the main crux of this story.
He has a connection to the lake generations back.
He does, yes. So his great grandfather, times four, so great, great, great grandfather, was Fielding Gar. So that is of the Fielding Gar Ranch, which is near the Antelope Island, if I remember correctly. And so he, part of this story is also that, you know, Chris's father passed away a couple years ago of Alzheimer's, and he had a really difficult time kind of dealing with this. And so the Great Salt Lake kind of became a place where he could go and like find answers to these spiritual questions he was having about his life and his father's passing. And I think there's a quote in the story from Chris where he says, "It's my place where I can have therapy." And, you know, I think another through line in this story is everyone to a certain degree, I think, is aware of the Great Salt Lake and the state and fate of it and what's going on. But for Chris, it's almost this personal thing. And, you know, we talk about the Great Salt Lake in wonderful, amazing reporting that, you know, the Tribune that has done and so many other news organizations about, you know, the statistics and the science that is so important. But Chris's story was so personal. So he really wanted to tap into that through, you know, this story that I wrote. And that's what he wanted to get into with his fashion line, too.
So he had this idea, even a specific vision of a dress based on the Great Salt Lake, but he's not a fashion designer. So how did he get this done?
He is not, but he is a big fashion fan. In fact, this didn't make it into the story, but when I interviewed Chris, we did a Zoom interview, and his desk, the entire bookcase behind his desk is full of fashion books, just like lookbooks and stuff. And so he ended up recruiting a bunch of students throughout the state. There are 20 pieces in the collection, and these students are designers from Utah State University and Salt Lake Community College. And each student has a different design that they have picked up, and we feature a couple of those in the story. One of them was also by a professor who teaches fashion and design up at Utah State University. So there's a lot of side-by-side images in the story about, you know, what was Chris's original picture, you know, that he had in mind, and then how did this designer recreate that?
I wonder if you could do your best attempt at describing some of these for radio. Of course, we'll urge people to go to sltrib.com, pull up this story, get these wonderful side-by-side photographs, but maybe take a couple of these and describe them.
Of course. I think I will describe Yisbel Birmingham's gown. So she did a microbialite gown. And for people who don't know, microbialites are essentially mineral deposits that produce oxygen. And these are all around the Great Salt Lake, to my understanding. And they kind of look almost like dehydrated coral, if that makes sense. It's a very brown organism, so to say. And so on her dress, when I talked to her, you know, she spoke a little bit about wanting to portray the dress as the waterline recedes from the Great Salt Lake. And as a result, when that happens, the microbialites die and they kind of dry out and turn this tan color. And so in her dress, which is kind of a blue strapless gown, you know, it's very blue. It's like the color you would associate with a healthy lake. And then the microbialites start kind of at like the neckline and they trail down. And, you know, the darker sort of dead microbialites at the top are darker. And then they go from like deep brown to tan and then to a really light color, which is what they're supposed to be when they're covered in water. And, another interesting aspect of this project is a lot of these designers, like most Utahns, were aware of the Great Salt Lake in general, right? They're aware that, it's having problems, that it's terminal. But Yisbel said that she didn't realize before she started on this project, how much life there is around the Great Salt Lake, because people just talk about it like it's dead. And so that gown was really interesting. It's such a, these pieces in this collection, I think, really match Chris Carlson's photography so directly. And he, really had a hands-on approach working with the students to get, the right texture of the microbiolites and other things like that. I think, if I remember correctly, Yisbel said she made around 400 replicas of one mineral deposit, one microbiolite, and it took her a really long time to get the texture of that, like in a way that she felt was satisfactory. And then she had to make 400 more of them. So it's really an interesting series here of work that's being put in by not just Chris, but all of these student designers too.
Chris Carlson says charts don't change hearts. What's it? So this is not just fashion. I guess he wants to draw attention to the lake, does he?
That's, I think, essentially his whole goal with this project is to get people to care about the lake as much as he does. And one of the things that we talked about a lot was, like I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of science and reporting around the Great Salt Lake, but it's not often that people are connecting to that, in Chris's opinion. So there's a quote in the story where he talks about how charts don't really change hearts. And, putting numbers and data in front of people, it's not having the impact he thinks it should be having. And so he gave me an example about a bird, for example, that lives around the Great Salt Lake. And if he had said, like, this bird lives on the south end of Antelope Island and he has a family, and his name is Henry, people would automatically be more drawn into that story than to just say, thousands of birds rely on the Great Salt Lake for alive to live, And so I think really Chris's focus on this project is, yes, this amazing environmental thing that we have in Utah, but how can we get those things to connect with people specifically? And so, you'll see in the story there's a picture of a red-winged blackbird, for example. And the design that they did off that is a cape. And it has kind of also just like these feathers, this neck piece too. And it's really, making the Great Salt Lake into something people will see often, and not just have this idea that the Great Salt Lake is, out there and it's dying. And he wants to put the lake, I guess I would say, at the forefront of people's minds.
Well, thank you for telling us about this. We're talking on this part of Behind the Headlines with culture and music reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, Palak Jaiswal. I want to move to this. This story is several weeks old, but I think an important story. We haven't had a chance to talk about it on this program. Here's the headline. Here's why Utah has become one of America's surprising plastic surgery hotspots. You did this with data columnist Andy Larson.
So, this story that Andy Larson and I did stemmed from this idea that is Utah a hotspot for plastic surgery, right? I think we see certain representation in reality TV, that we wanted to get to the heart of that question. And something that we discovered while reporting on this story is that there isn't a lot of data available about state-by-state plastic surgery. And so a lot of the data in the story, the only data available that Andy could find. And so, there's a map in there about how many plastic surgeons are there per capita, because surgeons have to register with a national database. And Utah has, I believe, three 0.24 plastic surgeons, which translates to 110 plastic surgeons in total based on per capita. And there's just a lot of interesting data. Andy kind of went into it with, you know, what search terms are most popular in Utah, for example. If you go by the Google search data, less than a decade ago, Utah ranked number 26 in terms of number of searches per capita for plastic surgery. But in 2025, it was ranked number 3. So it was an interesting kind of journey for Andy and I to figure out, can we answer this question of why or if Utah is a hotspot for plastic surgery? You know, when we talk about those search terms, one of the most fascinating parts of data that Andy was able to uncover is the term mommy makeover. Utah is number 2 in the country for searching that term over the last 12 months. So, you know, that kind of data prompted us to look into, you know, who is getting plastic surgery in Utah. And so that was my part of the story. You know, I talk to the people in the story. So, you know, we spoke to 2 surgeons. One of them does more body work, Dr. Rose. And Dr. Rose is really well known, especially in the reality TV type of circle. He has worked with some of the Secret Lives of Mormon Wives women. And the other doctor we talked to, Dr. Patel, he was more of a facial surgeon, and, you know, with neck lifts and stuff like that. So, you know, it was a really interesting kind of dynamic of, like, when we think of plastic surgery, you know, it wasn't just one thing. There is a lot of things that Utahns were going to plastic surgery for. And it also wasn't just like a one gender type thing. We found in our reporting that, you know, Dr. Patel mentions that a lot of his patients are actually male that come for, you know, facelifts or neck lifts or stuff like that.
You talked to some researchers, Sarah Coyne and Lauren Barnes. They looked at the crossover between body image, cosmetic surgery, and religiosity. There's a religious element here. And of course, in Utah, the predominant religion, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yes, definitely. Like I said, there wasn't a lot of data for us to go off of in the story. And so one of the things that we did find was a couple of studies that had been done in the recent year by people wondering the same thing that we were. And so one of these studies is the one that you mentioned. And I talked to Sarah Coyne. Their study is from 2023, and they had a sample of just over 1,300 Latter-day Saints aged 18 to 70 from across the nation. So it wasn't specific to Utah. And they had some really interesting findings. You know, Sarah told me that, you know, if someone is saying that their religion is really important to them, they tended to have less cosmetic surgery, which is really odd given, you know, we live in Utah. There's a very high religious population here, but, you know, there's a certain stereotype here of everyone having cosmetic surgery, as Sarah said. And most, they had a lot of interesting findings in their survey, but one of the ones that we nod to is nearly 14% of the people they surveyed had major cosmetic surgery, and 20% had cosmetic enhancements. There's also this aspect of costly grace. And as Sarah says, costly grace means this is a belief that I have to earn God's love and grace. And so, you know, we talked a lot about how perfectionism tends to be a very high cultural factor in Utah within the faith, and I think outside of the faith too, right? There's a certain idea of meeting standards, sometimes unrealistic standards. And this was echoed a little bit by a study done from Utah Women in Leadership Project, which was Susan Madsen is the director of that. And we talked a little bit about those kind of cultural and religious influences that happen in the state that can lead to this hotspot, so to say. I think one part of their research that really stood out was, you know, homogeneous societies such as Utah can have this kind of effect that pressures people into cosmetic surgery. And so really, I think when we talk about the culture of Utah and how that plays a role into plastic surgery, it does go back to religion a little bit. It's kind of living up to these very high standards that Utahns have for themselves.
You talked to a Utah resident, Lehi resident, Amy Williams. She had six kids. She's that really affected her body. And so she decided to get, I think it was breast augmentation. She wanted, I think in this case, to feel, reclaim femininity. What does she want?
Amy was really interesting. She is a patient of Dr. Rose's, and she had her first augmentation, I believe, 8 years ago, and that was right after she had her last child. She breastfed all six of her children, and Amy is also a full-time fitness influencer, so to say. She has strength training classes that she does for women out in Pleasant Grove. And she really, felt that doing the line of work that she does, while also losing weight and trying to reclaim her body after having her children, she wanted to make a decision where she felt confident in herself. And so, she said that because of all of those factors, she felt that she had a very flat chest. She felt masculine. And so she wanted to restore that femininity, which is what led her to that first augmentation. She recently got a second one. And that first time, she talked about how it completely just restored her confidence. And so I think Amy is a really interesting case. Because when we think of plastic surgery, I think we have a certain idea in our heads of who gets it and why they get it. But Amy, has a really different perspective to that. She did it to regain her confidence. So that was really interesting to hear from someone who lives in Utah and had decided to do a procedure.
She says the women that she sees, I guess, in her class and such who have plastic surgery, she feels like most of them are more confident and outgoing after the surgery.
I think, Amy spoke a little bit about being able to see this visible difference, not just physically, but emotionally, spiritually, in these women that come to her classes. So, one interesting fact too is, I think people might think that Utah County is like plastic surgery capital of Utah, but it turns out that there are more surgeons registered in Salt Lake County than Utah County. And that was one of the great data points that Andy was able to dig up. So,
Now, Dr. Patel, you referenced him earlier. He says Utah's the, I guess, the capital of mommy makeovers. What's a mommy makeover?
that's a good question. I think it depends on who you're asking, but I think mommy makeover references, women kind of getting breast augmentations, tummy tucks, those types of procedures after having children. I think similar to Amy Williams, right? Where she, had her family and she wanted to feel confident in her body again after. And so I believe that is a loose definition of the mommy makeover.
And I don't know if this was, yeah, Dr. Patel, I think, said he sees women, they come to him when there's a life change, divorce, death in the family, they get in their late 40s and 50s, and they say, I became invisible. It's a phrase he hears.
It was really interesting talking to both of these surgeons. They've been doing what they do for a very, very long time. And a lot of this reporting, I think, came back to this idea of having self-confidence. And I really noticed that even the surgeons were noticing this. When they talk to people, I think it's actually Dr. Rose who speaks a little bit about like asking people what makes you happy, what makes you feel beautiful. And Dr. Patel also, he has years and years of experience, and he used to do body work as well. One thing he said that really stuck out to me was, there was a time, say 10 years ago, that plastic surgery was only meant for this kind of upper class, people who were in a higher financial bracket. But in the last 10 years, Patel has said that he's started seeing ordinary people who work ordinary jobs, housewives, secretaries. And so I think, answering this big question that Andy and I set out to answer, is Utah hotspot? I think you can say yes, it is. And there's a lot of factors about why that's true.
Are there any of the people you talked about? I think in certain circles there's a stigma about plastic surgery. Maybe that's changing. Any surgery, I guess, has some inherent dangers, right? And you might get a botched surgery, for example, and any negatives that people highlighted.
Yeah, that's a great point. We know that this happens. I don't think we get a lot into this in the story itself, but at the top of the story, we talk about Jessie Draper, the Secret Lives of Mormon Wives star. She's very open about discussing the procedures that she's done. And one that she had recently, like she's not happy with. I believe in that case, it wasn't any of the surgeons in the story that did that procedure for her. But I think that's a part of it too, right? Is there a level of regret in these procedures if they don't turn out the way that people wanted them to? And so that's something that we weren't able to really get into in this story, but I'm sure that's another area that people can look into. I think it kind of depends on what you want and what kind of surgeon you go to, so.
And certainly do your research. I mean, that's what a couple of the people in the story emphasize. Do your research if you're going to do this.
Yes, definitely. It was really, really interesting talking to Dr. Patel and Dr. Rose because, with the kind of way that it feels like plastic surgery is everywhere, they very specifically had protocols and ways that they approach patients who came to them for these procedures about why are you doing this? What do you want from this? And so it's a big decision, but clearly it's one that a lot of Utahns have made. So
Let's take a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a break, we'll continue with Salt Lake Tribune culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. Here's the headline. After only 2 years, a new language class has hundreds of students connecting to their culture. And we'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We continue our conversation with Salt Lake Tribune culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. So, Palak, this story really, and we're doing, should set this up, we're doing some stories we've missed, haven't discussed on this program over the last few weeks. Recording this on Monday, you're hearing this on Friday. This really stood out to me, Palak. After only 2 years, a new language class has hundreds of students connecting to their culture. What language are we talking about?
We are talking about Diné Bazad, which is the Navajo language.
And so this is a place you might not think of having a center, Salt Lake, right? You think of reservations, etc., but this is in Salt Lake. What do they do at the center?
Yeah, so these classes happen at the Urban Indian Center, and they started about 2 years ago, I would say. And the Urban Indian Center is actually celebrating 52 years this year, and it has three different locations. But these classes are taught at the Salt Lake City location. So this Diné Bazad class is part of the Urban Indian Center's larger rebalancing culture program, which is just a way. A very specific program and way for members of the Urban Indian Center and people who, identify as Indigenous and live in the city area, to reconnect with their culture. And it started off as a pilot in 2024. The woman who works at the Urban Indian Center, their outreach manager, Rhonda Honey Duval, it's kind of the brain behind this program. And she grew up going to the center as well. She's been going since she was 3 years old, and she calls it her third home. And so it was kind of this full circle moment of like paying it back with this class to the community.
It's interesting language. I mean, I obviously don't speak it, but I think you mentioned, or somebody mentioned in your story, it's a tonal language, and very connected with what family, right? The instructor instructs people, the people in the class who are learning or relearning the language to, first thing you do is introduce yourself and what family you're a part of.
Yes. So, you know, this course is taught by Clarissa Yazzie, who, for those who are Star Wars buffs might recognize her. She voiced Leia, Princess Leia, in the Star Wars kind of Navajo voiceover version that they did a couple of years ago. So Clarissa went to Rock Point Community School in Arizona, and it was one of the first two schools in the reservation where they taught Navajo literacy. And so, you know, her journey with teaching this class started with that Star Wars movie. And then, you know, she taught a class at her alma mater, and then she ran into Rhonda Duval at an event, and Rhonda was like, I really, you know, I need to find someone who can teach this class. And at that time, Clarissa had also been kind of teaching mini lessons for Navajo on social media. And that's kind of how the class started. But as you mentioned, Tom, you know, there's a lot of kind of cultural roots in this language. When someone introduces themselves in Diné, they start by introducing themselves with their ancestors. And so, you know, when I sat and observed this class, everyone of the students had this yellow piece of paper that had all of their clans on it. And that was, you know, them learning how to introduce themselves. And then also in that class, they worked on kinship trees or family trees, so to say. And a lot of the way that Clarissa approaches teaching this class is through that ancestral knowledge, and really getting people to understand, you know, it's not just a big vocabulary lesson. It's how can you put this language into your everyday actions? So one example is in the course, we went to the intermediate course, but in the basic course, the students had learned, you know, terms or vocabulary for the kitchen or cooking, you know, something they would use on a daily basis. And they were still working on incorporating those terms in their daily lives in the second course. And so it's kind of a really slow cultural approach to this language. And they've seen hundreds of students come through the doors to learn it in the past couple of years.
Several people you talk to, so they really appreciate connecting to their culture through, you know, language and culture are very closely connected.
Yes, I think so. I think, you know, there is a person we interviewed in this story. He's at the top. His name is Herbert Smith. And Smith grew up in New Mexico on the east side of the Navajo Nation Reservation. You know, he grew up learning both English and Diné Bazad. And you know, he knows this language, but since he's been working in Salt Lake for years and years, and he doesn't get home to the reservation very often, this class really helps refresh his memory and his mind. And he has a quote where he says, you know, language is important. Language has always been the foundation of every culture. And I think all of these students, you know, there's another student we talked to down lower in the story who is kind of on the younger side. His name is Caden Stevens, and he described going to this class as, you know, it feeds his spirit being around this community of people who are trying to learn the same thing that he is. And so I think this class also is, it's for everyone. It's for people who are fluent speakers and are just wanting to stay fresh. It's for people who have never spoken Navajo or, you know, have heard words of Navajo from their parents and never really quite picked it up themselves. And so I think it's a really interesting story of culture. And we have all these unique pockets of culture in Utah. And I think this is one example of it.
Well, we're just about to the end of our time here. If we had time, we were going to talk about your interview with Brandon Mole, of course, the author of the Fable Haven series. They're going to turn that into a movie, I guess, or a series. So check that out at sltrib.com. Also, I just loved your story on a local band, Salt Lake City band called The Grimm in the 1960s. They're just taking off, about to get a record deal. and they were drafted into the Vietnam War. They've re-upped now. They're older, but they're rocking again. So check that one out as well. Before we go, Pilot Jaiswal, I know you're culture and music editor. You're totally into music. Give me a couple of artists or albums that you're excited about right now.
Oh, of course. I started as the culture reporter, and then I had them tag music on a year after because I'm very passionate about it. But this year, I've been really loving the new Harry Styles album. It's called Kiss All the Time, Disco Occasionally. I'm a big Harry Styles fan, so take that, of course, with a grain of salt. But I think it's a really good album, top to bottom. I've also really enjoyed kind of music releases this year. The new Noah Kahan album is also constantly playing for me, and he's actually coming to Utah on tour later this year. There's a great new Kacey Musgraves album out, and there's also a really good The Band Camino album out. So it's been a big year for new music, I think.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for telling us about all these stories. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. Palak, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Our thanks to culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal, you heard from just then, and earlier in the program, reporter Brooke Larson. And just a note, we will be skipping the program for the 4th of July weekend. Give the reporters a break next week. And so I hope you'll be with me again in 2 weeks for Behind the Headlines.